Coming up on Tech Nation, a cognitive scientist looks at dogs and their capabilities of smell. You may find some surprising explanations of your dog's behaviors, and for that matter, your cat's. Dr. Alexandra Horowitz is the author of Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. Then on Biotech Nation, a Johns Hopkins scientist visits Puerto Rico, and the result is a next-generation proteomics company. Dr. Ignacio Pino is the CEO of CDI, located in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
There are plenty of old sayings, many of which we know to be privately true. Take, you are what you eat. No one follows you around day and night, recording every morsel. So more or less, we can likely agree, at least quietly, that it's true. Same goes for, you are what you repeatedly do. Most of what we do, nobody notices, not even ourselves. So what may turn out to be important in its very repeating is often not noticed. But let's say that we repeatedly procrastinate. We all know there are consequences. You say to yourself, "Oh, I need to do this, but then I'd rather not right now." Later, you say to yourself, later. And then later, later again. Well, there's a new entrant in this historic line of sayings, and it may send you scurrying to your handy wipes. It turns out you are your mobile phone. A study conducted by the University of California, San Diego's medical school, in collaboration with its School of Pharmacy, studied the mobile phones of 39 volunteers and scanned not for their selection of apps, not for what information they viewed, or even their usage. No, they scanned for molecules and microbes. First, let's just stop and think about it. Most of the time, you and only you hold your phone, and you hold it a lot during the day, at night, while we work, play, get bored, etc. For some people, just holding their phone in their hand is either a replacement for old Teddy or just a habit. They arrive, phone in hand, and set it down where they can have access to it. I know someone who has set his phone such that every time a message arrives or an email lands, it doesn't quietly vibrate. No, it sets off a piercing ding, and somehow the phone actually flashes. In a recent half-hour conversation, we were treated to this reward no less than 6 times. No doubt, science should study that as well. But the study I'm referring to was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and this paper is more significant than it appears. In fact, it introduces the concept of skin-associated lifestyle chemistries found on personal belongings as a form of trace evidence. First, you need what is called a representative personal belonging, like your phone. And then science can provide insights into personal lifestyle profiles by predicting the kind of beauty product the individual uses, the food he or she eats, the medications he or she takes, or the places he or she has been. While sort of creepy, you can definitely imagine the irate dad glaring at his miscreant teenage son, who has just come home at 3:30 in the morning. Pop holds out the evidence bag and says, "Okay, sonny boy, put your phone right in here." Well, the evidence bag is actually the clue. According to the journal, the chemical interpretation of traces recovered from objects found on a crime scene can help a criminal investigator learn about the lifestyle of the individual who used or touched these objects. Boy, we sure are a long way down the road from fingerprints. Even DNA doesn't make this kind of contextual contribution. But it still seems troubling. Will the next billionaire be someone who comes up with a material that will kill all the microbes on contact? Even so, we're moving into a world where molecules and microbes can be read on the spot. That will change a lot of things. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with cognitive scientist Dr. Alexandra Horowitz, the director of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard. She's here today with Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. Then on Biotech Nation, Dr. Ignacio Pino relates how a Johns Hopkins scientist visited Puerto Rico, and the result was next-generation proteomics company CDI. While Dr. Alexandra Horowitz writes about dogs and their capabilities in terms of smell, she refers to humans as being microsmatic. That's micro, plus an S, then matic, microsmatic.
Correct, right, meaning we're considered kind of weak-nosed. We don't really smell terrifically well, especially compared with lots of other animals.
We just don't have the equipment.
You know, our noses are decent. All the olfactory researchers I talked to said our noses are actually pretty good. And there's good evidence for that. And the evidence is if you tasted your food today, taste is mostly smell. As you know, when you have a cold and your nose is congested, maybe you don't taste your food very well. But it's smell through the back of the mouth. What we don't do a lot of is smell through the nose, through the nostrils. And of course, even though we have decent equipment, it's much inferior to animals like dogs.
Now, compare our nose to the nose of a dog.
There are lots of ways I could do that. Well, I'll start simply with just one of the anatomical features. One would be, how many receptor cells do you have? The smell receptors that actually are doing the first stage of the smelling. It's a little part of the nose right between the eyes, called the olfactory epithelium. We have a couple of million smell receptors. Dogs have hundreds of millions of smell receptors. And they have more kinds of receptors. So just as we have 3 color receptors, imagine if we had 100 color receptors.
Or you see can imagine. We could see infrared.
Right. Precisely so. Right. That's just one other ability. It's an ability to detect one other part of the frequency spectrum. So we don't really understand, in fact, what it means to have that many olfactory receptors as the dogs do. But so they have many, many more and many, many more kinds of receptors.
Now, you're a cognitive scientist by training, by education. When we're talking receptors, that means it all feeds back to the brain. Can we see all those connections in the brain of a dog?
Right. So the olfactory lobe, which is the place where smell comes into the brain, is right behind the nose. So there's just one neuron that separates those receptor cells that are grabbing the smelly stuff out of the air, and if they fire, and the brain. It just goes right from the back to the brain. And the olfactory lobe in dogs is also relatively bigger compared to the rest of their brain than ours is, meaning that it probably is more important for dogs than for us to smell.
Can we see it if we put them in an MRI?
Sure, you can. I mean, dogs have smaller brains generally, so it won't necessarily be that much bigger than ours. But relative to the size of the brain, theirs is really enhanced. Our visual cortex, for instance, is very large compared to other animals who are non-visual primarily. So you can kind of see in a gross way from just looking at a brain what kind of perception the animal has.
Now, you direct the dog cognition lab, and that's at Barnard,
right? Exactly,
in New York City. And when I just first read this, I thought, "Now is this like a small office with like two dog crates? Is this like is this like you know, there's a separate building with you know like a meadow in the middle of New York City? You know,
right?
Take us to the dog.
It's really
cognition
neither.
Log.
It's we
is that library books? See how much they like to read.
There's you know, I come from a cognitive science and psychology background. So when you think of lab, you think of like a white room. And maybe if you're studying primates, the one that, or
I was
mice.
Thinking a Labrador retriever since
right.
we're on dogs.
Labs in the lab that have animals there. So of course, we don't keep dogs. I'm interested in the owned dog. So we use spaces that at doggy daycares to run studies. We go out in the parks to study dogs. So there's really no one lab space. We go where the dogs are. And we do simple behavioral experiments and we do natural observations, just watching behavior, specific behaviors, and then trying to break them down. But we're very interested in that kind of natural behavior that comes up with a dog dealing with other dogs or dealing with their person.
And dogs love to sniff other dogs.
They sure do, right? And I think we should let them sniff.
It's not like some dogs. All dogs
yes.
like to sniff.
Yes.
All dogs.
Yeah. And surprisingly, it takes us, I think, as a society, a long time to realize that that's kind of okay, right? That they're getting information about each other from that sniff. It's not like we're sniffing each other, but we kind of put our values on the dog. If it would be kind of impolite for me to sniff your rump, so we maybe think that the dog shouldn't be doing the same thing.
You always hear that. No, 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 don't go back. No, no, no. But
precisely.
That's exactly what they're going for.
Yeah. That's where there's a lot of sort of signature scent information from what they call the rump area, the tail, anal glands, things like that. But also in the face. The face has a lot of glands, as ours does, you know, which is why a dog might be interested in sniffing your ears or around your eyes. It's information about kind of who the animal is.
Are there gender differences?
There is this interesting gender difference in how dogs approach other dogs, which is that female dogs seem to go to the face first to sniff and males go to the rump. So that does give us an indication that it has or used to have a reproductive function. So some of the information that they're getting is about whether the animal is ready to mate. A dog would be more interested in getting that information quickly, and the female is just looking for the identifying information.
Oh, what do you think she's trying to identify?
Well, who it is. You know, maybe their health. There are probably other elements of the signature scent that we don't even know about yet. I mean, that's still a basic research question. What is in the scent that's given off? Sometimes, you know, you can smell if somebody else is sick by a smell coming off of them. We know that dogs can do some, you know, cancer detection work. So maybe they can identify health of a dog in their smell, things like that.
Take us there, because you do discuss that in the book. It's a question of what are the dogs sensing?
With each other or detection?
In the cancer detection, yeah.
The cancer detection is this very interesting line of research. Now, dogs are able to detect, apparently, cancer odor volatiles in the breath of a person or in blood or in urine. And we don't actually know what it is that they're smelling. But they can reliably, there have been research that shows that they're reliably picking out the samples, which are cancerous when run on a trial. These aren't dogs going up and just sniffing people's, you know, mouths. They're dogs sniffing samples of exhaled breath of cancer patients and patients without cancer and positively identifying the ones with cancer. So there are people studying what is the smell, you know, that they're getting, because people would like to design an electronic nose, for instance. I could do that. We haven't found it yet.
That is one of the interesting things to me about reading your book, is like you'll take what we kind of generally know and then you'll go into the science and then you run into a big wall saying, and now we don't know anything. We'll hit a wall.
There's a lot of that. And it's surprising sometimes, I think, for people with something with an animal like the dog, that there's a lot that we might not know about, because certainly they're ubiquitous. They're in our homes. They're in our beds or on our couches. And so we think, well, we better know a lot about that animal, right? Because we've already let them this deeply into our lives. But I don't think we do really know that much about them. And the research on their behavior and cognition is very recent.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. Alexandra Horowitz, a cognitive scientist. She's an adjunct associate professor at Barnard College, where she also directs the Dog Cognition Lab. You might remember her from Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. She's here today with Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. Now, you were saying you were interested in owned animals. Is there a difference between, you know, city dwellers, dogs that live in little apartments in New York City and no grass in sight until they can get them over to a park, versus dogs that live in suburbia that are constantly outside, might be, you know, made to live outside?
Yeah. Well, there are differences based on the environment they're raised in, but overall, Western culture dogs are more similar than dissimilar. I mean, you could compare some of the Western dogs to, say, the free-ranging dogs in India, and I would say, well, probably behaviorally, you're going to see a lot of differences there. And definitely their relationships to people and to human society is different. But at the level of things we study, those dogs would both be good examples of dogs. You know, what they would have is different amounts of sociability, probably different exercise patterns, different levels of fear or confidence about certain situations. But the things we're looking at, they're basically both good dogs.
There's no difference in who they are, what they become, because nothing, the environment they're living
in. We're trying to get to something which is a little bit more essential than the environmental differences that you would definitely see having an effect on those dogs' behavior.
And now when we reframe the world in dogs, the idea that someone might be studying, multiple people might be studying free-range dogs in India, what's the situation of dogs in India?
Oh, well, most of the dogs in the world are not owned, surprisingly, right? And we would come from, in the States, the dogs I studies, you know, we feel like we have a good idea of who the dog is because it's the adjunct to us. But in most of the world, most of the dogs are living around human society, but not specifically owned by a person, maybe fed by people or feeding off of people's remains, trash. So that's very different. Those might be dogs who live in groups, for instance, instead of dogs who go out with a person and maybe see a group of other dogs in a park, or maybe don't every day.
Now, I've had cats and I've had dogs, and I learned something here. A dog marks, but a cat bunts?
Oh, yeah. Well, a mark seems to be, which is leaving, you know, a little bit of urine. We don't exactly know what the purpose is for dogs, but they leave marks along shared pathways, you know, that they walk with other dogs. In wolves, it's territorial. It was something about marking the home territory so other wolves get the information about where this pack is living. Dogs don't seem to have the same phenomenon. In other words, they don't. What is their territory? It might be their home, but they're not marking the perimeter of your house, right? But they still do this marking. And so we're trying to figure out what it's about. But it's about leaving information for other dogs, definitely. When a cat is bunting, they're trying to get their scent on something that they kind of own, which would be your their person.
And how do they mark?
Well, there will be
bunting. What is bunting?
The bunting is the face kind of shoving their face where there are a lot of glands. Cats have a lot of glands around their mouth, onto something that can receive those glands, so it then smells of them. It's an interesting phenomenon, given that a lot of cats will live indoors and not run into any other cats, but they're still leaving their scent on their people and everything around in the environment. A new item that comes into the home, they'll go right for it and try to bunt it with their face. So that's related, but a different thing than what our dogs are doing.
I had a cat that used to do that to me every day.
Yes. They don't seem to grow tired of it. Also, we wash off the scent. We need to be re-scented.
I was uncooperative.
That's right.
Like, what is this cat?
If only you showered less, that would be a good experiment.
That'd be good. I see. Well, Teddy ain't around to test anymore, but we have another cat. We'll definitely test it. Which brings us to expired turbulent nostril air jets.
Oh, that's
otherwise,
a lovely phrase.
And then you all of a sudden hear this.
Precisely. Right. So there are people who study the fluid dynamics of a sniff, basically. And they have discovered this wonderful phenomenon that dogs do which makes them quite different from humans as sniffers, which is that they exhale better than we do. They have, you'll know if you look at the dog's nose, side slits next to their nostrils. And instead of just exhaling out the main part of the nostrils like we do, if you want to get rid of a smell in your nose, the first thing you do is try to exhale it out. And it can sometimes get the odor right out of the receptor cells and back into the air. The dogs exhale out these side slits. And what that does is it means they can get a continuous smell image coming in without having to exhale it out with every breath. And it also, conceivably, if they're close to the ground, will create a little puff of air that brings more odorant molecules to their nostrils to be sniffed. So it's a kind of amazing, ingenious design.
Now, I live in San Francisco, and we've always heard that dogs could smell earthquakes. Apparently, none of our particular dogs. They were not saying earthquake, not jumping up, going, let's run out of the house here. Is there a scientific basis for this?
Well, I think we can only speculate now, right? I mean, as you say, it's not all dogs. And first, and also, we know that dogs don't, or we could expect that dogs wouldn't have, you know, a real knowledge of earthquakes per se. But it doesn't mean that they couldn't notice a difference that's potentially an olfactory difference in the air prior to an earthquake or a storm. You know, pressure is changing, for instance, at a distance. When air pressure changes, then if it gets lower, for instance, as before a storm, then the earth can release some of its molecules into the air, and then sort of suddenly new smells in the air that the dog would notice. And so they might seem to be active suddenly, as though they've noticed something. And then sure enough, if you have an earthquake 30 minutes later, it feels like they've predicted it. What they've done is noticed that the quake has already begun, or that the storm has already begun. It just hasn't reached you yet. And it's possible smell could help them with that.
Now, if someone is interested in being a dog scientist, I mean, one of the first things you've got to do is see, how do you think what the scientific study is? And I liked your study in New York City.
The one in the park?
Yeah, the P-Post.
The P-Post, right. Yeah. In fact, that's still ongoing. We're continuing with that. And that was an interest in marking and what marking is about. And this is basic research. What you say is, listen, there haven't been a lot of people really explaining what the dog is doing. So what we have to do first is observe the dog. So we put out a post. We just called it a pee post in the park. It's a new item in the park. So plenty of dogs coming through every day, morning, middle of the day, in the afternoon. And they want to examine the post. And we basically set up a camera to record who was sniffing, you know, who was marking. If we could, we'd see who followed whom. We'd see when the dogs came by, you know, to start to get a fuller picture of what the phenomenon might be based on the behavior of the dogs, a whole bunch of dogs, not just my own dogs that I observe. And we're still doing it. And then when we finally get, you know, some good hypotheses, maybe we'll test them in a more controlled setting. But we saw some nice things. Like one of the things I like was thus far is that dogs aren't typically coming back around later in their walk to sniff where they've marked before. In other words, they might be leaving a calling card for other dogs on this post, but then they don't come and check and see if anybody's picked it up or anybody's left another one on top of it. They leave it. They're kind of shouting into the wilderness, but not listening for a response. It's interesting.
Just letting you know I'm here.
Just letting you know I'm here, right? And sniffing who's been there before, but there's a lot more sniffing than marking, to be sure. So there's a lot of finding out about the world and occasional leaving, but not a lot of follow through. And partly that's because, you know, owners lead them around. They don't get to choose where they go.
Which leads us to RLD.
The raised leg display?
Yes. So you get into science. You got to name things and you got to abbreviate them. I'm just showing
Absolutely.
People how to do
no,
science
it's important.
Here. It's just
that's how you know it's science.
Yeah.
The raised leg display. Yeah, that is part of the marking display and probably also attracts other dogs visually might see that somebody's leaving an odor to be investigated, and they'll draw them to the scene so that they can investigate it with their nose.
And that's both female and male, even
Many
though
females will do that, right.
That females will also do that, which
right.
is not their typical
way of relieving themselves.
Right.
Absolutely, right. And it can be learned. So, you know, puppies aren't usually doing this, which again indicates that there might be a reproductive component to the marking leaving, that animals who are not reproductively ready are not doing the marking. Yeah, and not every dog does the raised leg display either, but some, you know, can do all sorts of gymnastic feats to make sure that their urine hits a high mark.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
To be sniffed by the tallest dogs.
You are learning so much.
This is the stuff. If you want to run a dog cognition lab, you're going to be dealing with some dog pee. That's all I can say.
That's how it works. Just that's it. Well, what is this business of the, I want to call it the 21-second rule. I'm not sure it's called that, to empty bladders across a whole number of animals.
Right. This was this fascinating research done across species to see what the capacity of the bladder was, how long that they were, it took to relieve themselves. And I'm not remembering. Was it a 21 seconds?
I thought it was 21
even,
seconds.
Even more, but yeah.
Could be 23.
That somehow
but
it was scaled.
Like, it was a maximum.
It's very similar across species. It seems to be like scaled to the size of the animal, you know, the size. So, and also, by the way, those we know if a dog is doing that, that's not a mark. You know, that's just they've been inside too long. You should have taken them for a walk earlier.
Yeah.
If they have that full a bladder.
But it applies to elephants.
It applies to, you know,
horses,
small rodents and elephants and the things in between. Yeah, it was a surprising discovery. Yes.
It's a surprising discovery. I mean, in the world of human technology, the bigger it is, the longer it takes.
Right.
But there's something surprising here.
Yeah.
You got my attention. I'm not going to look into it a lot, but you did get my attention. And speaking of getting attention, dogs wagging tails, they're not just glad to see us?
It's one of those behaviors that I love thinking about because it's one of them that we think we know already, right? Everyone knows what a tail wag is, or that's a happy tail wag, as you say, glad to see us. That's still true. You know, there are kind of assertive tail wags, and then there are kind of guilty-looking tail wags. There are different kinds of tail wags, but we thought it's all about communicating something visually. But it occurred to me, after watching enough dogs greet each other, that they're doing something else with their tails, which is that when they wag their tails in greeting, they're also more effectively spreading the odor from their rump. And in fact, the reason I think this is a pretty good hypothesis is that we do see this in other animals. Hippos, for instance, kind of vaporize their urine with their tail by waving their tail as they pee. And that spreads the odor further so that you don't have to come right up to the close to the animal to smell the scent of who it is. It will be wafting off of them, and the tail helps with that. So I think it has a secondary purpose.
One thing we always associate with dogs is this, and certainly certain breeds, is this ability to be great trackers. Mm. Do we know any more about that than we did just knowing that they were good trackers?
Well, there has been research about just how good tracking dogs can be. And there's wonderful research from some scientists saying that, for instance, a tracking dog can tell the difference between the first and fifth footstep of a left behind.
I've been speaking with cognitive scientist Dr. Alexandra Horowitz, the author of Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, the next generation proteomics company, CDI. Stay with us. Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with cognitive scientist Dr. Alexandra Horowitz, author of Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell.
One thing we always associate with dogs is this, and certainly certain breeds, is this ability to be great trackers. Mm. Do we know any more about that than we did just knowing that they were good trackers?
Well, there has been research about just how good tracking dogs can be. And there's wonderful research from some scientists saying that, for instance, a tracking dog can tell the difference between the first and fifth footstep of a left behind by a person fleeing or wandered off, lost somewhere. And what that indicates, and from that they can tell the direction that the person went. So if they run into a track of the person, they can see by the concentration of odor, the different concentration of odor in the first and fifth footstep. There will be more in the fifth because it's slightly newer, 2 seconds newer, typically, than the old one. So that's an indication of, and it gives it direction. So somehow this is the way I think smell kind of tells time for dogs, by the concentration of the odor left in this footstep, which is minutely different. They can tell which one is more recent and which footstep is older, and thus which way the person went.
I thought that was interesting how you were talking about smelling time. We always think we're smelling something now, but given their ability to smell, they can smell that which happened quite some time ago. They can smell now, generated now, and they, as you were saying, you know, from the rainstorm far off, they can smell future. So it's one thing to say I can smell a lot. It's a different thing to understand that it also has the dimension of time.
Yeah, I think smell kind of rubber bands time for dogs, or it makes the moment broader. So they're smelling underfoot when they walk out of your house and go for a walk. The odors kind of wafting off of people and dogs who have passed by recently that have fallen and now are on the ground. So that's a little bit of the past. But maybe they can also smell, if the air, the breeze is right, the odor of somebody around the corner down the street who you can't see yet, who hasn't arrived at you, but their odor might have traveled to the dog's nose ahead of time. So they're seeing a little bit of what's up ahead.
You frequently return to humans. I guess we're born with much better smell than we have as we go on.
Yeah, in fact, you used the word earlier, microsomatic. The babies are sometimes considered macrosomatic, like dogs, because they don't have very good vision at birth and are probably mostly finding their way by smell. They find their mother's breast by smell, by glands around the nipple. They find their way to get their meal. So it's a very adaptive quality and feature. And over time, we seem to lose the priority of smell as vision takes over. And also, we're not encouraged in our smelling. If we notice a smell, we don't have a good vocabulary that adults put on the words for smells. So we might not name it. And adults rarely reward a baby's noticing a smell or an infant's noticing a smell. So it seems as though we have this capacity and then we just let it go dormant.
I smell something. Oh, yeah, sure. You know, it's not like, yeah, ooh, you're going to be a rocket scientist or a lawyer or
a
doctor. Yeah.
Even, like, you know, if a baby, if an infant learning to speak points at a dog and says, doggy, that, you know, everybody coos and applauds and, you know, it's like, yes, the thing that you see is a dog. But if they tried to point out or comment on a smell, it might not even, it would go basically unnoticed. And so there's none of that reward or encouragement that that's the thing they should notice in the world.
Well, we're born with, you know, so many more capabilities to smell, and then it kind of comes down. But you actually tried to improve your sense of smell.
I did, right. So one of my ways of trying to imagine what it's like to be a dog was basically to try to become a better smeller myself. So one of the ways I tried to imagine what it might be like to be an olfactory creature like the dog was to practice smelling myself and try to improve my sense of smell. I didn't think I had a very good sense of smell. And so what I did is I went to sommeliers and perfumers and I practiced with them doing what they did so that I could start to discriminate more smells and notice a smell where I hadn't before. And it was a fantastic experience. I mean, basically, I started with very little interest in smell per se, and I wound up being kind of annoyingly interested in smells. I can't go on a walk without pulling a leaf off a tree and, you know, picking things up from the ground and trying to smell them.
Now, would you say that your smell improved or that you noticed it more?
It's absolutely to do with noticing, but you do need to practice naming and bringing. First of all, you have to bring things to your nose or put your nose in things like dogs do. Otherwise, you won't notice. We usually only experience this great smell memory connection inadvertently. You walk into a room, it smells like something familiar, like your grandmother's attic, and suddenly you're there in your grandmother's attic.
I have a PS45 smell. PS45 right here. It could be anywhere.
Right.
But it takes you right back.
It does, but it's not something we consciously did, obviously. You weren't there as a child thinking, oh, the smell. I'm going to try to remember the smell. But when you do that deliberately, then you get this much bigger corpus of smell memories that then you can appeal to more and more as you smell new things. So the intentional nature of it is important.
Of course, we have a rich tradition of service dogs, the working dog. Is there any science around that, about developing that whole? Because it seems like this is extremely important and prolific throughout our culture.
Right. The training of working dogs, of all types of detector dogs, is right now basically undergoing scientific kind of validation. There's definitely very standardized protocols for training, very certification procedures. It's not like it's off the map. There hasn't been a lot of research on validating specific approaches over others. So for instance, if you have a whole bunch of dogs bred to be a detector dog in a specific breed line, it would be great if you could reliably train them so they all become detector dogs. Right now, that doesn't happen. Some fail in the program, even though genetically they seem suitable. They don't make it for whatever reason. And so I did follow Dr. Cindy Otto and all her great trainers and researchers at Penn Vet's Working Dog Center for a while. And that's the type of thing they're trying to do now, to validate approaches that have been used or to strengthen the approach that's been used to scientifically and reliably train working dogs.
It's not just a cute beagle walking through the customs.
It's still a cute beagle walking through. And of course, they're trained. It's not as though these dogs are not trained. They're very carefully trained. It's just that which training approach works hasn't been the subject of research. It's more practical. You know, you train the dog. If it works, you use the dog. If it doesn't work with a dog, you don't use that dog, right? So Cindy and her colleagues are interested in finding an approach so that you can, you know, reliably get dogs who have the drive, who have the motivation, who have the genetic skill to wind up as detection dogs.
And yet there are some very interesting things. I mean, I was fascinated by when we humans shake hands, there's some unconscious follow-on behavior.
There was a really interesting study done recently where, in fact, as it happens with some psychological studies, the real study happened before the study. Interviewers came in to say hello to subjects who'd volunteer for a study and shook their hand and said, you're going to be waiting here for a minute until the study starts. And they would go on and do the study, but they were being videotaped. The subjects were being videotaped in that time, in that little preamble time. And what they found is that people sniffed the hand that they shook or brought it near their nose and seemed to be maybe unconsciously, probably unconsciously, smelling the person odors of the interviewer. So there might be some vestigial way that we use smell that unconsciously shapes or used to shape our behavior.
Now, were they looking for that when they did the study?
That's what they were looking for,
Sometimes it's really great because you're looking at one thing and something like that pops up. And
right.
Says, hey, look over here.
Well, they did see unusual effects. I think it was same-sex, usually. Interviewer subjects, same-sex, were more likely to sniff the hand that had been handshaked than cross gender. So that was probably unexpected, is my guess. I think they probably would have predicted the other way, but that's what they saw.
Well, there is lots more in this book, Alexandra, and it sure was a lot of fun. So keep up the good science.
Thank you very much. Come back and see us. I will. Thanks.
My guest today is Dr. Alexandra Horowitz. The book is Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell. It's published by Scribner. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation.
Today on Biotech Nation, a Johns Hopkins scientist visits Puerto Rico, and the result is a next-generation proteomics company. Dr. Ignacio Pino is the CEO of CDI, located in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico.
I was building a company for cattle vaccines. That's what CDI, Caribbean Dairy Institute. Now it's a proteomics company, which is the study of proteins. And I will go, I guess, in detail into that. But around 2007, probably winter, because that's where usually northerners go down to Puerto Rico. I got a call from a friend that said, hey, I have some Johns Hopkins friends here in Rincon, which is a nearby town known for its beautiful waters, that are here, and you know, they've invented something and they are here on vacation, but they've heard that there's movement in the island to start seeding startups to see how we can take advantage of the ecosystem that exists because of the years of pharmaceutical manufacturing and growth of these companies in the island. And they want to get a feel of it, see if Puerto Rico may be a good place to start something. And I'm not in the island. Can you help me? You know, I said, okay, sure. That got me to meet my partners today.
Who are just on vacation nearby.
A call. And, you know, at the time I was thinking, yes, I had a sort of some critical mass around my idea of establishing a vaccine company for cattle, but at the same time had some losses in my family to cancer. So biomedical was starting to really call me. So sort of trying to see what I could do, you know, put my grain of sand and see if we could find a cure for all these nasty diseases someday. And their inventions came from Johns Hopkins University and were obviously related to biomedical medicine. So, you know, I just said, okay, let me take these people around, show them a little bit of the what's happening. We took them to what was under construction, which is where we are now. It's called the Bioprocess Development and Training Complex, which is an incubator pilot facility that was being built in Mayagüez. And I was obviously circling it like a shark because I had my...
Let me in.
Yeah, I wanted to be the first one in there. So these founders, Jeff, actually one of them, not all of them, but the leader of the team from Hopkins was in with his wife at Rincon. And I took Jeff around and showed him an empty lot and, you know, a trailer there. But then the people there show us the floor plans and all that. And he started to say, oh, maybe, you know, this
is a fresh start.
It's a fresh start. There was a what's called the Puerto Rico Science and Technology Trust, which is a non-for-profit organization. So the trust was put together with some monies to push science as an economic driver for Puerto Rico, science and technology. So that was starting. It was just virtual, but they already had a trustee committee, and they were rumbles that they may provide some seed funding if some interesting projects will come. And we said, hey, Jeff, you like this? I have a company. I just won a business plan competition. I have $30,000 worth of seed funding. Let's join forces and, you know, create a company around the technologies you've invented with your partners at Hopkins. And
so what was the technology that the partners from the scientists from Hopkins had invented?
So the technology comes out of a center at Johns Hopkins called the HIT Center, or High Throughput Biology Center. And the idea behind the High Throughput Biology is to create tools that would accelerate research, more on the basic side of things, how to accelerate that we really understand how cells work. And, you know, and obviously that leads to knowledge that eventually percolates down to the, you know,
new drugs
and therapies, diagnostics.
Yeah.
But their focus is very early. It's really understanding how we function. But they've created a young scientist that Jeff had hired for the HIT Center, had created a large protein microarray. And what that is, it's a glass slide treated with a special polymer so that things stick to it. A glass slide like the one that we use in biology class. And on that glass slide, then he started creating on the other end a copy or a replica, a laboratory replica of each of our own proteins, right? Because
in the human body, where all these proteins
are building blocks. Because there's the genes, right? The genes are, I think we can see them as the blueprint. You know, it's how the cell or our body knows how to build us. But we're made out of proteins, right? And that's where the drugs need to act. That's where when they're defective, they go crazy and we get cancer. That's when we get an autoimmune disease and our own body starts attacking. It's not our genes. It's our own proteins, right? That's what we're made of.
The genes go through the RNA to produce the protein.
Correct.
So your genes determine what proteins are created or incorrectly created.
Correct. So to really understand and advance science, you need really now all that beautiful information that the genomic era gave us and convert it into the proteomic, you know, counterpart so that then we can actually do experiments against the actual parts that are involved in the action, right? So Hang Zhu, one of my founders and partners and professor also at Johns Hopkins said, Hang always thinks big. You know, it's like for Hang, an experiment that is less than 1,000 reactions or something like that, it's not in his, he doesn't register that. He's a high throughput person. So he said, let's take all the genes in the human genome and let's make one replica, you know, let's create that process that you said, RNA to DNA in the lab and have the protein for each one of those. And then let's take those and print them basically like you would print paper, you know, on these glass slides. And let's take these glass slides now and use scanners that were used in the genomic era to read them.
So let me ask you this. Do you have protein ink?
Basically, we have protein
like
ink. We have 20,000 vials of different colors, quote unquote, of protein ink, basically. And the good thing is, it's not that we have to redo the whole process. What Hang created was a collection of expression clones. So we have little yeast cells that express
the protein.
The protein. So now we have little factories that we go back, bring them out, express the 20,000 proteins in one big manufacturing event, and then we don't need a lot because these are micro dots what we're printing. So we take all that and we give it to a robot that then does the printing. Now we have these glass slides. We initially, what Hang and, you know, the group at Hopkins did was use it to discover a lot of events that happen in the cell, which led to incredible papers they published that opened up a new knowledge. But when I saw it, and Jeff was thinking was, well, this is good for basic research, but this tool has incredible uses in biomedical, you know, applications that can really accelerate, you know, biopharmaceutical development, knowledge on how
everybody
a disease works.
Everybody looking at anything in this area
correct.
Needs it.
It's
yes.
like, imagine trying to figure out this in a human. Now you have the human divided in its parts on an addressable chip that you can immediately see what's going on. It just accelerates tremendously.
Now, the way you see what's going on is you put you actually match something from an individual human and put it on the slides.
Correct.
And then if they have a matching protein, it lights up.
Correct. Let's use a good example, like an autoimmune disease, where, as we all know, let's talk about lupus so that we put something in our mind. Lupus, people are attacking their own body, their antibodies that we normally make to defend ourselves from infections and viruses, all of a sudden start attacking our own
proteins. They see our own proteins as enemies, even though they shouldn't be.
Correct. So, you know, a lot has been done for lupus. Really, it's really not, it's a little bit of a guesswork, especially when there's not only lupus, but a but a whole portfolio, if you will, of autoimmune diseases that look alike and that each potentially may require a different treatment or a different treatment strategy. And right now, there's not good ways of sorting them out and be precise of what this patient has. Now, with this tool, you can take this patient's antibodies that are floating on their serum, which is the watery part of our blood, and you can profile them or put them in contact with the chip that is a replica of the human, of that person, and now you can, with fluorescent probes, come back to those, wash that out, and if any of these antibodies, you know, recognize one of these proteins, it's going to stick to it. And now with the fluorescent probe, you're going to be able to scan it with this laser scanner and see an image that, you know, in a lupus patient, unfortunately, looks like a Christmas tree.
Lights up. Yeah. Well, that's right. If all things were equal and you were totally normal, none of your antibodies should attack you.
There's always some that is normal, but in a lupus
below
patient.
Below a certain level.
Correct.
You should see a pretty clean slide here because your antibodies shouldn't be attacking
correct.
You. But
correct.
If you have lupus, it's attacking you.
Correct. And now we can do multiple patients to get, you know, statistically accurate data. We can compare it to normal patients, and we can see which one are the lupus marks. And if we do that for RA or rheumatoid arthritis, then potentially slightly different. And now we can start to come up with diagnostics that can really tell you which one really it is.
Which antibodies are attaching, which proteins may be of enormous significance.
Correct.
We couldn't see that before.
Correct. And not only it tells you, oh, now I can, you know, decipher who has what, but also, well, maybe if I start blocking that, I can make them better, right? So it gives you not only the information you need to better diagnostics, but also a hint at potential new targets, potential new ways of trying to treat this disease that although we do have some pharmaceuticals to combat them, you know, it's
guesswork.
It's a yes, and not really accurate and precise.
Now, you, of course, are back here in Mayagüez, and you're making a business out of it.
Correct.
So you're selling both the slides with the human proteins in it. So people can order from you, we want these proteins, and you can say, oh, we'll print you up some slides and send them out. Or they might be sending you samples, and you'll just give them the answers as to what lights up.
Correct. Because, you know, we become, on the process of building these technologies, we become experts at using them. So a lot of our users prefer that we, the experts, do it. Some love the technology and think they're going to use it enough that decide, no, you know, I want to bring it in-house, teach me, you know, and I'll just get the chips from you and all the other reagents that we may need. And so yeah, that's basically what we do. We do a lot also of, that's one example of one of the major low-hanging fruits, if you will, of how this technology affects biomedicine. But the other is the opposite. It's when you want to profile a molecule because against this human on a chip, because you want it to be very precise. So you don't want to see many things light up. You want to see only one. And that one should be the target that drug is supposed to interact with. So imagine you're a drug company. You want to create safe drugs. Right now you create, you start your process. You go down to 100 leads. Now you start testing them. Maybe you start doing safety. You know, maybe you encounter safety problems when you start injecting them to human because, you know, you didn't have really a good way of assessing that. With this tool now, you can really, you know, clean up your starting pool of molecules and only start with the ones that are,
no guesswork, exactly what
you
believe.
Very precise.
Very precise. Most people, if they know anything about Puerto Rico, 100 miles long, 40 miles wide, and it's like, well, Old San Juan. Now, where is Mayagüez in relation to Old San Juan?
Old San Juan is north, is the north coast. We're on the west coast. And the reason we're there is because the University of Puerto Rico is spread out sort of in campuses, and the Mayak West campus is world-renowned, I would say, for its engineering and biotechnology. And obviously, that's where we get the talent that really, I think, was the main reason, you know, Jeff, my partners, decided, yeah, Puerto Rico is a good place to start our company because, you know, as I told you, we make 20,000 individual proteins. That's not easy. You need a lot of dexterous hands. I mean, there's in biotechnology, although it's a high tech, you know, a business or sector, there's a lot of human eye, human touch that goes into each of these steps that you use either to make a drug or to make 20,000 proteins like we do. So knowing that we needed talent and ideally talent in a continuous, you know, flow so that we can keep growing as our company grows, hopefully, then, you know, it just that I think is sold us. I mean, I was sold. I'm a product of that system. So I was sold already. But to my friends, I think that combined obviously with we actually teamed up, created a proposal, went to that science trust that we mentioned. We actually got seed funding from them. And that's what we actually got to inaugurate that facility that I told you about.
Right.
You know, we were the first tenants there. We were three people in a little corner of a 15,000 square foot facility.
And you never look back.
Yeah. And
how many people today at CDI?
So today we're 26.
26.
Four of those 26 are in the U.S. because first we maintain a strong relationship with our Hopkins founder team. And we have a lab office at the Johns Hopkins Technology Park right next to our founders' laboratories. And we also, you know, are engaged in a lot of collaborations with Hopkins. Obviously, technology being built there, Hopkins has been a very early adopter and, you know, is taking advantage of these breakthroughs. So
good start. It's a good start.
It's a good place to start.
Well, for a veterinarian, it did really good in biotech, I can tell you.
Yep.
Still, I won't even ask. Next time, Ignacio, I'll ask you about the cattle vaccine.
I'm going to go back to that someday.
Someday. Dr. Pino, thank you so much. Please come back. See us anytime.
Thank you.
Dr. Ignacio Pino is the CEO of CDI, located in Mayaguez, Puerto Rico. More information is available at cdi-lab.com. That's cdi-lab.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.